nothing of the world. You cannot possibly know how rare such a situation is.
Oh, should not we walk? Mr. Knightley, will you show us the gardens? All the gardens. I wish to see the whole extent.
The party rose and walked some time over the gardens in a scattered, dispersed way, scarcely any three together, insensibly following one another through the avenues, paths, and lawns of the grounds. Emma and Mr. Weston, who had turned by another path, now saw all the others once more, and she immediately perceived Mr. Knightley and Harriet, distinct from the rest, quietly leading the way. Mr. Knightley and Harriet. It was an odd tête-à-tête, but she was glad to see it. There had been a time when he would have scorned her as a companion and turned from her with little ceremony. Now they seemed in pleasant conversation. The next remove was to the house. They must all go in and eat, and they were all seated and busy, and still Frank Churchill did not come. Mrs. Weston was concerned that he had met with an accident on his black mare, or perhaps Mrs. Churchill's health might prevent his visit. Emma looked at Harriet while the point was under consideration. She behaved very well and betrayed no emotion on Frank's arrival. It must be a charged subject for her, but she gave no notion of it. The cold repast was over, and the party were to go out once more. Mr. Woodhouse, who had already taken his little round in the highest part of the gardens, stirred no more, and his daughter resolved to remain with him, that Mrs. Weston might be able to explore. The party departed once more, and all was tranquility. Before becoming completely settled with her father, however, Emma walked into the hall for the sake of a few moments' free observation of the entrance and ground plot of the house. She was hardly there when Jane Fairfax appeared, coming quickly in from the garden with a look of escape.
Oh, Miss Woodhouse, you are the very person I was in quest of. Will you be so kind as to say that I'm gone home? I am going this moment. My aunt is not aware how late it is, nor how long we have been absent, but I am sure we shall be wanted, and I am determined to go directly. I have said nothing about it to anybody. It would only be giving trouble and distress. Some are gone to the ponds and some to the lime walk. Till they all come in, I shall not be missed. And when they do, will you have the goodness to say that I am gone?
Certainly, if you wish it. But you are not going to walk to Highbury alone.
I walk fast. I shall be at home in 20 minutes.
But this is too far. Indeed it is, to be walking quite alone. Let my father's servant go with you. Let me order the carriage. It can be round in 5 minutes.
Thank you, but on no account. I would rather walk.
But you are fatigued already. Let me order the carriage.
I am fatigued, but it is not the sort of fatigue. Quick walking will refresh me. Miss Woodhouse, we all know at times what it is to be wearied in spirits. Mine, I confess, are exhausted. Oh, for the comfort of being sometimes alone. The greatest kindness you can show me will be to let me have my own way, and only say that I am gone when it is necessary.
Emma had not another word to oppose. She promoted her quitting the house immediately, and watched her safely off with the zeal of a friend. Emma perceived the continual endurance that must be practiced by her, even towards some of those who loved her best. Such a home, indeed. Such an aunt, thought Emma, as she turned back into the house and rejoined her father. Jane had not been gone a quarter of an hour when Frank Churchill entered the room in some agitation.
Good day, Miss Woodhouse. Mr. Woodhouse.
Mr. Churchill, we're glad to see you. Mrs. Weston was quite concerned. Did you have trouble with your black mare?
My mare? No, sir. I was detained by Mrs. Churchill. She suffered a nervous seizure which lasted some hours.
Oh, dear. Is she quite well now?
Much better, sir, I thank you. It was a wretched journey, however. Had I known how hot a ride I should have, and how late, with all my hurry, I must be, I would not have come at all. The heat is excessive. I have never suffered anything like it. I almost wish I had stayed at home. Nothing kills me like heat. I can bear any degree of cold, but the heat is intolerable.
Well, you will soon be cooler if you can be calmer.
As soon as I am cooler, I shall go back again. I could very ill be spared, but such a point had been made of my coming. You will all be going soon, I suppose, the whole party breaking up. I met one as I came. Madness in such weather, absolute madness.
Emma listened and looked and soon perceived that Frank Churchill's state might be best defined by the expressive phrase of being out of humour. Some people were always cross when they were hot. She recommended his taking some refreshment, which he refused, then 2 minutes later walked off, muttering something about spruce beer. "I'm glad I've done being in love with him," thought Emma. "I should not like a man who is so soon discomposed by a hot morning. Harriet's sweet, easy temper will not mind it." He was gone long enough to have had a comfortable meal and came back all the better, grown quite cool, and though he was not in his best spirits, seemed trying to improve them.
"We are going to Box Hill tomorrow. You will stay, Mr. Churchill, and go with us."
"No, certainly not. I shall go home in the cool of the evening."
"But you may come again in the cool of tomorrow morning."
"No, it will not be worthwhile. If I come, I shall be cross."
"Then pray stay at Richmond."
"But if I do, I shall be crosser still. I can never bear to think of you all there without me."
"These are difficulties which you must settle for yourself. Choose your own degree of crossness. I shall press you no more."
"Well, if you wish me to stay and join the party, I will."
The rest of the party were now returning, and all were soon collected. With some, there was great joy at the sight of Frank Churchill. Others took it very composedly, but there was a very general distress and disturbance on Miss Fairfax's disappearance being explained. That it was time for everybody to go concluded the subject, and with a short final arrangement for the next day's scheme, they parted. The party had a very fine day for Box Hill. Mr. Weston directed the whole, officiating safely between Hartfield and the vicarage. Emma and Harriet went together, Miss Bates and her niece with the Eltons, the gentleman on horseback. Mrs. Weston remained with Mr. Woodhouse at Hartfield. Nothing was wanting but to be happy when they got there. 7 miles were travelled in expectation of enjoyment, and everybody had a burst of admiration on first arriving. But in the general amount of the day, there was deficiency. There was a languor, a want of spirit, a want of union, which could not be got over. They separated too much into parties. The Eltons walked together, Mr. Knightley took charge of Miss Bates and Jane, and Emma and Harriet belonged to Frank Churchill. Mr. Weston tried in vain to make them harmonise better. It seemed at first an accidental division, but it never materially varied. At first, it was downright dullness to Emma. She had never seen Frank Churchill so silent and stupid. He said nothing worth hearing, looked without seeing, admired without intelligence, listened without knowing what she said. While he was so dull, it was no wonder that Harriet should be dull likewise, and they were both insufferable. The first walk over, they all sat down on blankets arranged on the ground, and the mood lifted. Frank Churchill grew talkative and gay, making Emma his first object. Every distinguishing attention that could be paid was paid to her. To amuse her and to be agreeable in her eyes seemed all that he cared for, and Emma, glad to be enlivened, not sorry to be flattered, gave him all the friendly encouragement which she had ever given in the first and most animating period of their acquaintance, but which now, in her own estimation, meant nothing. In the judgment of most people looking on, however, it must have had such an appearance as no English word but flirtation could very well describe. Mr. Frank Churchill and Miss Woodhouse flirted together excessively. They were laying themselves open to that very phrase, and to having it sent off in a letter to Maple Grove by one lady, to Ireland by another. Not that Emma was gay and thoughtless from any real felicity. She laughed because she was disappointed with the day, and though she liked him for his attentions and thought them all, whether in friendship, admiration, or playfulness, extremely judicious, they were not winning back her heart.
"How much I am obliged to you, Miss Woodhouse, for telling me to come today. If it had not been for you, I should certainly have lost all the happiness of this party. I had quite determined to go away again.
Yes, you were very cross. I was a kinder friend than you deserved.
Don't say I was cross. I was fatigued. The heat overcame me.
It is hotter today.
Not to my feelings. I am perfectly comfortable today.
You are comfortable because you are under command.
Your command, yes. You order me whether you speak or not. And you are always with me.
Dating from 3 o'clock yesterday.
3 o'clock yesterday? That is your date. I thought I had seen you first in February.
Your gallantry is really unanswerable. But nobody speaks except ourselves. And it is rather too much to be talking nonsense for the entertainment of 7 silent people.
I say nothing of which I am ashamed. I saw you first in February. Let everybody on the hill hear me if they can. I saw you first in February. Oh, Miss Woodhouse, what shall we do to rouse our companions? Any nonsense will serve. They shall talk. Ah, I have it. Ladies and gentlemen, I am ordered by Miss Woodhouse to say that she desires to know what you are all thinking of. Mr. Knightley, you are a fluent gentleman.
Is Miss Woodhouse sure that she would like to hear what we're all thinking of?
Oh, no, Mr. Knightley. Upon no account in the world, let me hear anything rather than what you are all thinking of.
It is a sort of thing which I should not have thought myself privileged to inquire into. Do you not agree, Mr. E?
Very true, my love. Very true. Exactly so, indeed. Quite unheard of. But some ladies say anything. Better pass it off as a joke.
It will not do, Miss Woodhouse. They are, most of them, affronted. I will attack them with more address. Ladies and gentlemen, I am ordered by Miss Woodhouse to say that she now only requires something very entertaining from each of you, besides myself, who, she is pleased to say, am very entertaining already. She only demands from each of you either one thing very clever, be it prose or verse, original or repeated, or 2 things moderately clever, or 3 things very dull indeed, and she engages to laugh heartily at them all. Miss Bates, you give the only ready smile of the party.
Oh, simply because I need not to be uneasy, Mr. Churchill. 3 things very dull indeed. That will just do for me, you know. I shall be sure to say 3 dull things as soon as ever I open my mouth, shan't I? Do not you all think I shall?
Oh, Miss Bates, but there may be a difficulty. Pardon me, but you'll be limited as to number. Only 3 dull things at once.
Oh. Well, to be sure. Yes, I see what you mean, Miss Woodhouse. And I will try to hold my tongue. I must make myself very disagreeable, or you would not have said such a thing to an old friend.
Who shall be the first to attempt the challenge? Mrs. Elton, perhaps?
No. Miss Woodhouse must excuse me. I am not one of those who have witty things at everybody's service. I have a great deal of vivacity in my own way, but I really must be allowed to judge when to speak and when to hold my tongue. Pass us. If you please, Mr. Churchill, pass Mr. E, Knightley, Jane, and myself. We have nothing clever to say. Not one of us.
Yes, yes, pray pass me. I have nothing to say that can entertain Miss Woodhouse or any other young lady. An old married man, quite good for nothing. Would you like to walk, Augusta?
With all my heart. I am really tired of exploring so long on one spot. Come, Jane.
I shall stay, I thank you.
Mr. and Mrs. Elton departed with a haughty air and disapproving looks meant just to be caught by the party they left behind. Frank Churchill waited until they were just far enough off before commenting.
Happy couple. How well they suit one another. Very lucky, marrying as they did, upon an acquaintance formed in only a few weeks in Bath. Peculiarly lucky. How many a man has committed himself on a short acquaintance and rued it all the rest of his life. What think you, Miss Fairfax?
Such things do occur, undoubtedly.
Go on, Miss Fairfax.
I was only going to observe that a hasty and imprudent attachment may sometimes arise, but there is generally time to recover from it afterwards. It can be only weak, irresolute characters whose happiness must be always at the mercy of chance, who will suffer an unfortunate acquaintance to be an oppression forever.
Very true, indeed. But I have so little confidence in my own judgment that whenever I marry, I hope somebody will choose my wife for me. Will you, Miss Woodhouse? Will you choose a wife for me? I'm sure I should like anybody fixed on by you. Find somebody for me. I'm in no hurry. Adopt her. Educate her.
And make her like myself?
By all means, if you can.
Very well. I undertake the commission. You shall have a charming wife.
She must be very lively and have hazel eyes. I care for nothing else. I shall go abroad for a couple of years, and when I return, I shall come to you for my wife. Remember it, Miss Woodhouse.
Emma was in no danger of forgetting. It was a commission to touch every favourite feeling. Would not Harriet be the very creature described? Hazel eyes accepted? 2 years more might make her all that he wished. Jane Fairfax and Miss Bates soon walked off to join the Eltons, followed in half a minute by Mr. Knightley. Mr. Weston, his son, Emma, and Harriet only remained, and the young man's spirits now rose to a pitch almost unpleasant. Even Emma grew tired at last of flattery and merriment. The appearance of the servants looking out for them to give notice of the carriages was a joyful sight, bringing the prospect of the quiet drive home, which was to close the very questionable enjoyments of this day of pleasure. Such another scheme, composed of so many ill-assorted people, she hoped never to be betrayed into again. While walking towards the carriages, she found Mr. Knightley by her side. He looked around, as if to see that no one were near, and then spoke to her in a lowered voice.
Emma? I must once more speak to you as I have been used to do. A privilege rather endured than allowed, perhaps, but I must still use it. I cannot see you acting wrong without a remonstrance. How could you be so unfeeling to Miss Bates? How could you be so insolent in your wit to a woman of her character, age, and situation? Emma, I had not thought it possible.
Nay, how could I help saying what I did? Nobody could have helped it. It was not so very bad. I dare say she did not understand me.
I assure you she did. She felt your full meaning. She has talked of it since. I wish you could have heard her honouring your forbearance in being able to pay her such attentions as she was forever receiving from yourself and your father when her society must be so irksome.
Oh, I know there is not a better creature in the world. But you must allow that what is good and what is ridiculous are most unfortunately blended in her.
They are blended, I acknowledge. And were she a woman of fortune, I would not quarrel with you for any liberties of manner. Were she your equal in situation, but Emma, consider how far this is from being the case. She is poor. She has sunk from the comforts she was born to, and if she live to old age, must probably sink more. Her situation should secure your compassion. It was badly done indeed. You, whom she has known from an infant, whom she has seen grow up from a period when her notice was an honour, to have you now in thoughtless spirits and the pride of the moment laugh at her, humble her, and before her niece, too, and others, some of whom would be entirely guided by your treatment of her, this is not pleasant to you, Emma, and it is very far from pleasant to me, but I will tell you truths while I can. Satisfied with proving myself your friend by very faithful counsel, and trusting that you will sometime or other do me greater justice than you can do now.
Her carriage was ready, and before Emma could speak again, he had handed her in. He had misinterpreted the feelings which had kept her silent, her face averted. They were combined only of anger against herself, mortification and deep concern. She had not been able to speak, and on entering the carriage, sunk back for a moment, overcome. Then reproaching herself for parting in apparent sullenness, she looked out for him, but it was just too late. He had turned away, and the horses were in motion. She continued to look back, but in vain, and soon, with what appeared unusual speed, they were halfway down the hill and everything left far behind. She was vexed beyond what could have been expressed, almost beyond what she could conceal. Never had she felt so agitated, mortified, grieved at any circumstance in her life. The truth of his representation there was no denying. She felt it at her heart. How could she have been so brutal, so cruel to Miss Bates? And how suffer Mr. Knightley to leave her without saying one word of gratitude, of concurrence, of common kindness? Time did not compose her. As she reflected more, she seemed but to feel it more. She never had been so depressed. Happily, it was not necessary to speak. There was only Harriet, who seemed not in spirits herself, fagged and very willing to be silent. And Emma felt the tears running down her cheeks almost all the way home, without being at any trouble to check them, extraordinary as they were. The wretchedness of Box Hill was in Emma's thoughts all the evening. If attention to Miss Bates in future could do away the past, she might hope to be forgiven. She had been often remiss. Her conscience told her so. Remiss perhaps more in thought than fact, scornful, ungracious, but it should be so no more. In the warmth of true contrition, she would call upon Miss Bates the very next morning, and it should be the beginning on her side of a regular, equal, kindly intercourse. She was just as determined when the morrow came, and went early that nothing might prevent her. Upon reaching the Bates's apartment, she rejoiced for the first time in being told the ladies were at home. She followed the maid into the passage and up the stairs. There was a bustle on her approach, a good deal of moving and talking. She heard Miss Bates's voice. Something was to be done in a hurry.
Quickly, into your room, Jane. I shall see you are laid down upon the bed.
Do not let her come in.
The maid looked frightened and awkward, hoped Emma would be pleased to wait a moment, and then ushered her in too soon. Jane, she had a distinct glimpse of, looking extremely ill before the door was closed.
Oh, Miss Woodhouse, very happy and obliged. Please do sit down.
Thank you. I hope Miss Fairfax is well.
Oh, how kind you are. I suppose you have heard and have come to give us joy. This does not seem much like joy indeed in me, but it will be very trying for us to part with her. After having her so long. And she has a dreadful headache just now from writing all the morning. Such long letters, you know, to be written to Colonel Campbell and Mrs. Dixon, with tears in her eyes perpetually. One cannot wonder. It is a great change. Do not think us ungrateful, Miss Woodhouse, for such surprising good fortune. But poor dear soul, if you were here to see what a headache she has... When one is in great pain, you know, one cannot feel any blessing quite as it may deserve. She is as low as possible. To look at her, nobody would think how delighted and happy she is to have secured such a situation. You will excuse her not coming to you. She is not able. I want her to lie down on the bed. She will be extremely sorry to miss seeing you, Miss Woodhouse, but your kindness will excuse her.
Emma was most sincerely interested. Her heart had been long growing kinder towards Jane, and this picture of her present sufferings acted as a cure for every former ungenerous suspicion, and left her nothing but pity. She spoke as she felt, with earnest regret for Miss Fairfax's suffering. Jane, she learned, was to go to a Mrs. Smallridge, an intimate of the esteemed Mrs. Suckling, and have charge of three little girls. It was the situation which Emma had heard spoken of on their day at Donwell, and although it was at first refused, Jane had since come to the resolution of accepting it. Miss Bates knew nothing of it till it was all settled yesterday evening. Emma saw how deeply the change would be felt by Miss Bates. She ventured to offer any possible little comfort that came to mind.
Whenever the time may come, it must be unwelcome to her and all her friends, but I hope her engagement will have every alleviation that is possible. I mean, as to the character and manners of the family.
Thank you, dear Miss Woodhouse. Yes, indeed. There is everything in the world that can make her happy in it. Mrs. Smallridge, I understand, is a most delightful woman. her style of living, almost equal to Maple Grove. And as to the children, they are all elegance and sweetness. Oh, Jane will be treated with such regard and kindness. It will be nothing but pleasure, a life of pleasure, and her salary. I really cannot venture to name her salary to you, Miss Woodhouse. Even you, used as you are to great sums, would hardly believe that so much could be given to a young person like Jane.
Oh, madam, if other children are at all like what I remember to have been myself, I should think even the most generous salary dearly earned.
You are so noble in your ideas.
And when is Miss Fairfax to leave you?
Very soon. Very soon indeed. That's the worst of it. Within a fortnight. Mrs. Smallridge is in a great hurry.
Her friends must all be sorry to lose her. And will not Colonel and Mrs. Campbell be sorry to find that she has engaged herself before their return?
Yes. Jane says she is sure they will, but yes, this is such a situation as she cannot feel herself justified in declining. I was so astonished when she first told me.
Emma repeated with all sincerity how much Jane would be missed by Hartfield, and Miss Bates, in her turn, spoke of their set and in particular of Frank Churchill, who had returned to Richmond immediately after the return of the party from Box Hill. A messenger had brought a few lines from his uncle, containing a tolerable account of Mrs. Churchill and only wishing him not to delay coming back beyond the next morning early. But Mr. Frank Churchill resolved to go home directly without waiting at all. There was nothing in all this either to astonish or interest, and it caught Emma's attention only as it united with the subject which already engaged her mind, the contrast between Mrs. Churchill's importance in the world and Jane Fairfax's struck her. One was everything, the other nothing. Such reflections brought fresh thoughts of Jane's suffering in her own room, and Emma felt her visit had been long enough. With a repetition of everything that she could venture to say of the good wishes which she really felt, she took leave. Emma's pensive meditations as she walked home were not interrupted, but on entering the parlour she found those who must rouse her. Mr. Knightley and Harriet had arrived during her absence and were sitting with her father. Mr. Knightley immediately got up, speaking in a manner decidedly graver than usual.
Emma, I would not go away without seeing you, but I have no time to spare, and therefore must now be gone directly. I'm going to London to spend a few days with John and Isabella.
Is not this a sudden scheme?
Yes, rather. I've been thinking of it some little time.
Well, my dear, and did you get to the Bateses safely? And how did you find my worthy old friend and her daughter? You are always so attentive to them.
Emma's colour was heightened by this unjust praise, and with a smile and shake of the head, which spoke much, she looked at Mr. Knightley. It seemed as if there were an instantaneous impression in her favour, as if his eyes received the truth from hers, and all that had passed of good in her feelings were at once caught and honoured. He looked at her with a glow of regard. She was warmly gratified, and in another moment still more so by a little movement of more than common friendliness on his part. He took her hand. Whether she had not herself made the first motion, she could not say. She might, perhaps, have rather offered it, but he took her hand, pressed it, and certainly was on the point of carrying it to his lips, when from some fancy or other he suddenly let it go. Why he should feel such a scruple, why he should change his mind when it was all but done, she could not perceive. The intention, however, was indubitable, and the gesture was with him of so simple yet so dignified a nature. She could not but recall the attempt with great satisfaction. It was all done to assure her that she had fully recovered his good opinion. He left them immediately afterward, gone in a moment. In the hope of diverting her father's thoughts from the disagreeableness of Mr. Knightley's going to London, Emma communicated her news of Jane Fairfax, and her dependence on the effect was justified. The subject was interesting without disturbing him. He had long made up his mind to Jane Fairfax's going out as governess, and could talk of it cheerfully. The following day, however, brought news from Richmond to throw everything else into the background. An express arrived at Randall's to announce The death of Mrs. Churchill. She had not lived above 6 and 30 hours after her nephew's return. A sudden seizure, of a different nature from anything foreboded by her general state, had carried her off after a short struggle. The great Mrs. Churchill was no more. It was felt as such things must be felt. Everybody had a degree of gravity and sorrow, tenderness towards the departed, solicitude for the surviving friends. Mrs. Churchill, after being disliked at least 25 years, was now spoken of with compassionate allowances. In one point she was fully justified. She had never been admitted before to be seriously ill. The event acquitted her of all the fancifulness and all the selfishness of imaginary complaints. How it would affect Frank was among the earliest thoughts of the Westerns. It was also a very early speculation with Emma. She saw in a moment all the possible good the event may do him, how much freedom it may bring. Now an attachment to Harriet Smith would have nothing to encounter. All that remained to be wished was that Frank should form the attachment, as, with all her goodwill in the cause, Emma could feel no certainty of its being already formed. Harriet behaved extremely well on the occasion, with great self-command. Whatever she might feel of brighter hope, she betrayed nothing. Short letters from Frank were received at Randall's, communicating all that was immediately important of their state and plans. Mr. Churchill was better than could be expected, and their first removal, on the departure of the funeral for Yorkshire, was to be to the house of a very old friend in Windsor, to whom Mr. Churchill had been promising a visit the last 10 years. At present, there was nothing to be done for Harriet. Good wishes for the future were all that could yet be possible on Emma's side. It was a more pressing concern to show attention to Jane Fairfax, whose prospects were closing while Harriet's opened. Emma wanted to be of use to her, wanted to show a value for her society and testify respect and consideration. She wrote to urge her to spend a day at Hartfield. The invitation was refused, and by a verbal message. Miss Fairfax is not well enough to write. Her ill health was confirmed by Mr. Perry when next they saw him, and Emma remained eager to discover some way of being useful. In spite of Jane's answer, therefore, she ordered the carriage and drove to Mrs. Bates's in the hope that Jane would be induced to join her. But it would not do. Miss Bates came to the carriage door.
Miss Woodhouse, we are all gratitude for your kind visit. To think of you bringing the carriage for dear Jane. I agree with you entirely. An airing would be of great benefit to her, but she is quite unpersuadable. The mere proposal of going out seemed to make her worse.
I am sorry to hear it, Miss Bates.
Indeed, the truth is that poor dear Jane cannot bear to see anybody at all. Mrs. Elton, indeed, could not be denied, and Mrs. Cole had made such a point, and Mrs. Perry had said so much, but except them, Jane will really see nobody.
Emma did not want to be classed with the Mrs. Eltons, the Mrs. Perrys, and the Mrs. Coles, who would force themselves anywhere. Neither could she feel any right of preference herself, but there was a sting yet to be felt. Emma afterwards heard that Jane Fairfax had been seen that same afternoon wandering about the meadows at some distance from Highbury. She could have no doubt, putting everything together, that Jane was resolved to receive no kindness from her. She was sorry, very sorry. Her heart was grieved for a state which seemed but the more pitiable from this sort of irritation of spirits and inconsistency of action. And it mortified her that she was given so little credit for proper feeling. But she had the consolation of knowing that her intentions were good, and that could Mr. Knightley have seen into her heart, he would not, on this occasion, have found anything to reprove. Thank you. One morning, about 10 days after Mrs. Churchill's decease, Emma was called downstairs to Mr. Weston. He met her at the parlour door, and hardly asking her how she did, in the natural key of his voice, sunk it immediately to speak unheard by her father.
I cannot stay 5 minutes. Can you come to Randall's at any time this morning? Do, if it be possible. Mrs. Weston wants to see you. She must see you.
Is she unwell?
No, not at all. Only a little agitated. She would have ordered the carriage and come to you, but she must see you alone, without your father. Can you come?
Well, certainly. This moment, if you please. It is impossible to refuse what you ask in such a way. But what can be the matter? Is she really not ill?
Depend upon me. But ask no more questions. You will know it all in time. Only tell your father you shall take your walk with me now, since I was passing. We shall talk no more until we are past the sweet gates and quite out of hearing.
Emma agreed and promptly settled it with her father that she would take her walk now. She and Mr. Weston were soon out of the house together and on their way at a quick pace for Randall's.
Now, Mr. Weston, do let me know what has happened.
No, don't ask me. I promised my wife to leave it all to her. There is no occasion to be so uneasy about it. I don't say that it is not a disagreeable business, but things might be much worse. If we walk fast, we shall soon be at Randall's.
Who is that gentleman on horseback?
I do not know. One of the Otways, perhaps. Not Frank. It is not Frank, I assure you. You will not see him. He is halfway to Windsor by this time.
Has your son been with you, then?
Oh, yes. Did you not know? Frank came over this morning, just to ask how we did.
She asked no more questions, merely employed her own fancy, and that soon pointed out to her the probability of its being some money concern. They hurried on and were speedily at Randall's, where Mrs. Weston was looking so ill and had an air of so much perturbation that Emma's uneasiness increased. Mr. Weston left them together, and Emma was consumed with eager concern.
What is it, my dear friend? Something of a very unpleasant nature, I find, has occurred. Do let me know directly what it is.
Have you indeed no idea? Cannot you... My dear Emma, cannot you form a guess as to what you are to hear?
So far as that it relates to Mr. Frank Churchill, I do guess.
You are right. It does relate to him, and I will tell you directly. He has been here this very morning on a most extraordinary errand. It is impossible to express our surprise. He came to speak to his father on a subject... to announce an attachment, more than an attachment. Indeed, an engagement, a positive engagement. What will you say, Emma? What will anybody say when it is known that Frank Churchill and Miss Fairfax are engaged? Nay, that they have been long engaged.
Jane Fairfax? Good God, you are not serious. You do not mean it.
You may well be amazed, but it is so. There has been a solemn engagement between them ever since October, formed at Weymouth, and kept a secret from everybody. Not a creature knowing it but themselves, neither the Campbells, nor her family, nor his. I can hardly believe it. I thought I knew him.
Well, this is a circumstance which I must think of at least half a day before I can at all comprehend it. What? Engaged to her all the winter? Before either of them came to Highbury?
Engaged since October. Secretly engaged. It has hurt me, Emma, very much. It has hurt his father equally. Some part of his conduct we cannot excuse.
You are apprehensive of his attentions to me. You need not fear the effect, however. I am perfectly indifferent, and I shall give details to convince you of it. There was a period... in the early part of our acquaintance, when I did like him, when I was very much disposed to be attached to him, nay, was attached. And how it came to cease is perhaps the wonder. Fortunately, however, it did cease. I have really, for some time past, for at least these 3 months, cared nothing about him. You may believe me, Mrs. Weston, this is the simple truth.
Oh,
My dear Emma, hearing you say so has done me more good than anything else in the world could do. Mr. Weston will be almost as much relieved as myself. On this point, we have been wretched. It was our darling wish that you might be attached to each other, and we were persuaded that it was so. Imagine what we have been feeling on your account.
I have escaped, and that I should escape may be a matter of grateful wonder to you and myself. But this does not acquit him, Mrs. Weston, and I must say that I think him greatly to blame. What right had he to endeavour to please, as he certainly did, to distinguish any one young woman with persevering attention, as he certainly did, while he really belonged to another? How could he tell that he might not be making me in love with him? Very wrong indeed. And how could she bear such behaviour?
There were misunderstandings between them, Emma. He said so expressly. The present crisis, indeed, seemed to be brought on by them, very possibly from the impropriety of his conduct.
Impropriety? Oh, Mrs. Weston, it is too calm a censure. Much, much beyond impropriety. It has sunk him. I cannot say how it has sunk him, in my opinion. So unlike what a man should be. None of that upright integrity, that strict adherence to truth and principle, that disdain of trick and littleness, which a man should display in every transaction of his life.
Nay, dear Emma, now I must take his part. For though he has been wrong in this instance, he does have very many good qualities, and...
Good God! Mrs. Smallridge, too! Jane actually on the point of going as governess! What could he mean by such horrible indelicacy?
He knew nothing about it, Emma. On this article, I can fully acquit him. It was a private resolution of hers, not communicated to him till yesterday, which determined him to come forward at once, own it all to his uncle, throw himself on his kindness, and, in short, put an end to the miserable state of concealment that had been carrying on so long. He could only stay a quarter of an hour this morning, and that was in such a state of agitation that I know very little detail of the matter. But I am to hear from him soon. He told me at parting that he should soon write with many particulars that could not be given now. Let us wait, therefore, for this letter. It may bring many extenuations. It may make many things intelligible and excusable, which now are not to be understood. They must both have suffered a great deal under a system of secrecy and concealment.
His sufferings do not appear to have done him much harm. Well, and how did Mr. Churchill take it?
Most favourably for his nephew. Mr. Churchill gave his consent with very little persuasion. Conceive what the events of a week have done in that family. While poor Mrs. Churchill lived, I suppose there could not have been a hope, a chance, a possibility. But scarcely are her remains at rest in the family vault than her husband is persuaded to act exactly opposite to what she would have required.
And do you really believe the affair to have been carrying on with such perfect secrecy? The Campbells, the Dixons, did none of them know of the engagement?
None. Not one. He positively said that it had been known to no being in the world but their two selves.
Well, I suppose we shall gradually grow reconciled to the idea, and I wish them very happy. But I shall always think it a very abominable sort of proceeding.
There is Mr. Weston pacing the lawn. Yes, come in. Come in. Dearest Emma, I hope we can make the best of the situation. And indeed, almost everything may be fairly said in her favour. It is not a connection to gratify, but if Mr. Churchill does not feel that, why should we? I still believe, as I have always done, that she has such steadiness of character and good judgment, in spite of this one great deviation from the strict rule of right. And how much may be said in her situation for even that error?
Much indeed. If a woman can ever be excused for thinking only of herself, it is in a situation like Jane Fairfax's.
Miss Woodhouse, you have learned the truth.
Mr. Weston, a very pretty trick you have been playing, upon my word. This was a device, I suppose, to sport with my curiosity and exercise my talent of guessing.
My humblest apologies, Emma. I meant no trick, I assure you.
But you really frightened me. And here, instead of its being a matter of condolence, it turns out to be one of congratulation. I congratulate you, Mr. Weston, with all my heart, on the prospect of having one of the most lovely and accomplished young women in England for your daughter-in-law.
Do you mean it, Emma?
Of course.
Oh, then my mind is at ease again. With a little time and persuasion, I will think the engagement no very bad thing. Emma, I must trespass on your good nature once more and ask that for the present the whole affair is to be completely a secret. Mr. Churchill has made a point of it as a token of respect to the wife he has so very recently lost.
He judges well. It is no more than due decorum. I promise you that I shall not speak of it.
Even as she spoke, Emma knew that there was one person who must be accepted from her promise. Harriet. It was her superior duty to inform her of the engagement. Poor Harriet. Those were the words. In them lay the tormenting ideas which Emma could not get rid of, and which constituted the real misery of the business to her. Frank Churchill had behaved very ill by herself, very ill in many ways, but it was the scrape which he had drawn her into on Harriet's account that gave the deepest hue to his offence. Poor Harriet! To be a second time the dupe of Emma's misconceptions and flattery. Mr. Knightley had spoken prophetically when he once said, "Emma, you have been no friend to Harriet Smith." She was afraid she had done her nothing but disservice. It was true that Harriet had acknowledged her admiration and preference of Frank Churchill before she had ever given her a hint on the subject, but she felt completely guilty of having encouraged what she might have repressed. She was extremely angry with herself. If she could not have been angry with Frank Churchill too, it would have been dreadful. As for Jane Fairfax, she'd need no longer be unhappy about Jane, whose days of insignificance and evil were over. She would soon be well and happy and prosperous. Emma could now imagine why her own attentions had been slighted. This discovery laid many smaller matters open. No doubt it had been from jealousy. In Jane's eyes, she had been a rival, and well might anything she could offer of assistance or regard be repulsed. An airing in the Hartfield carriage would have been the rack. She understood it all, and as far as her mind could disengage itself from the injustice and selfishness of angry feelings, she acknowledged that Jane Fairfax would have neither elevation nor happiness beyond her desert. But poor Harriet was such an engrossing charge. There was little sympathy to be spared for anybody else. Emma was sadly fearful that this second disappointment would be more severe than the first. She must communicate the painful truth, however, and as soon as possible. A note sent to Mrs. Goddard's soon brought Harriet to Hartfield. Emma's heart beat quick on hearing Harriet's footstep and voice as she entered the drawing room.
Well, Miss Woodhouse, is not this the oddest news that ever was?
Oh, what news do you mean?
About Jane Fairfax. Did you ever hear anything so strange? Oh, you need not be afraid of owning it to me, for Mr. Weston has told me himself. I met him just now. He told me it was to be a great secret, and therefore I should not think of mentioning it to anybody but you. But he said you knew it.
What did Mr. Weston tell you?
Oh, he told me all about it, that Jane Fairfax and Mr. Frank Churchill are to be married, and that they have been privately engaged to one another this long while. How very odd. Had you any idea of his being in love with her? You, perhaps, might. You who can see into everybody's heart, but nobody else.
Upon my word, I begin to doubt my having any such talent. Can you seriously ask me, Harriet, whether I imagined him attached to another woman at the very time that I was tacitly, if not openly, encouraging you to give way to your own feelings? I never had the slightest suspicion till within the last hour of Mr. Frank Churchill's having the least regard for Jane Fairfax. You may be sure that if I had, I should have cautioned you accordingly.
Me? Why should you caution me? You do not think I care about Mr. Frank Churchill?
I am delighted to hear you speak so stoutly on the subject, but you do not mean to deny that there was a time, and not very distant either, when you gave me reason to understand that you did care about him.
Him? Never. Never. Dear Miss Woodhouse, how could you so mistake me?
Harriet, what do you mean? Good heaven, what do you mean? Mistake you? Am I to suppose, then?
I should not have thought it possible that you could have misunderstood me. I know we agreed never to name him, but considering how infinitely superior he is to everybody else, I should not have thought it possible that I could be supposed to mean any other person. I am sure, but for believing that you entirely approved and meant to encourage me in my attachment, I should have considered it, at first, too great a presumption almost to dare to think of him. At first, if you had not told me that more wonderful things had happened, that there had been matches of greater disparity, I should not have dared to give way to. I should not have thought it possible. But if you, who had been always acquainted with
Harriet, let us understand each other now without the possibility of farther mistake. Are you speaking of Mr. Knightley?
To be sure I am. I never could have an idea of anybody else, and so I thought you knew. When we talked about him, it was as clear as possible.
Not quite, for all that you then said appeared to me to relate to a different person. I could almost assert that you had named Mr. Frank Churchill. I'm sure the service Mr. Frank Churchill had rendered you in protecting you from the gypsies was spoken of.
Oh, Miss Woodhouse, how you do forget.
My dear Harriet, I perfectly remember the substance of what I said on the occasion. I told you that I did not wonder at your attachment, that considering the service he had rendered you, it was extremely natural, and you agreed to it, mentioning even what your sensations had been in seeing him come forward to your rescue. The impression of it is strong on my memory.
Oh, dear. Now I recollect what you mean. But I was thinking of something very different at the time. It was not the gypsies. It was not Mr. Frank Churchill that I meant. No. I was thinking of a much more precious circumstance. Of Mr. Knightley's coming and asking me to dance. When Mr. Elton would not stand up with me and when there was no other partner in the room. That was the kind action. That was the noble benevolence and generosity. That was the service which made me begin to feel how superior he was to every other being upon earth.
Good God. This has been a most unfortunate, most deplorable mistake. What is to be done?
You would not have encouraged me then, if you had understood me. I do not wonder, Miss Woodhouse, that you should feel a great difference between the two men, as to me or as to anybody. You must think Mr. Knightley 500 million times more above me than Frank Churchill. But I hope, Miss Woodhouse, that supposing that if, strange as it may appear, if I should be so fortunate beyond expression as to, if Mr. Knightley does not mind the disparity, I hope, dear Miss Woodhouse, you will not set yourself against it and try to put difficulties in the way. But you are too good for that, I am sure.
Have you any idea of Mr. Knightley's returning your affection?
Yes, I must say that I have.
Emma's eyes were instantly withdrawn, and she sat silently meditating in a fixed attitude for a few minutes. A few minutes were sufficient for making her acquainted with her own heart. A mind like hers, once opening to suspicion, made rapid progress. She touched, she admitted, she acknowledged the whole truth. Why was it so much worse that Harriet should be in love with Mr. Knightley than with Frank Churchill? Why was the evil so dreadfully increased by Harriet's having some hope of a return? It darted through her with the speed of an arrow that Mr. Knightley must marry no one but herself. Her own conduct, as well as her own heart, was before her in the same few minutes. She saw it all with a clearness which had never blessed her before. How improperly had she been acting by Harriet? Even so, how could she presume to believe herself loved by Mr. Knightley? Emma could not make her unhappy by any coldness, however. It would be most unjust, and yet for her own advantage it was fit that the utmost extent of Harriet's hopes should be inquired into. Rousing from reflection, therefore, and subduing her emotion, she turned to Harriet again, and, in a more inviting accent, renewed the conversation. She listened with much inward suffering, but with great outward patience, to Harriet's detail and the corroborating circumstances which her own memory brought in favour of Mr. Knightley's most improved opinion of Harriet. She knew that he saw such recommendations in Harriet. He had dwelt on them to her more than once. Her voice was not unsteady, but her mind was in all the perturbation that such a confusion of sudden and perplexing emotions must create.
Tell me, Harriet, when did you first observe a change in Mr. Knightley's manner towards you?
Ever since those two decisive dances. From that evening, or at least from the time of your encouraging me to think of him, I became sensible of his talking to me much more than he had been used to do. Indeed, he has had quite a different manner towards me, a manner of kindness and sweetness. He seemed to want to be acquainted with me.
But none of it signifies an attachment.
No, indeed, but just lately two moments have suggested the strongest promise of his sincere affection. The first was his walking with me, apart from the others, in the lime walk at Donwell. He seemed to be almost asking me whether my affections were engaged. But as soon as you appeared likely to join us, he changed the subject and began talking about farming.
And the second moment?
It was on the very last morning of his being at Hartfield. He sat talking with me nearly half an hour before you came back from your visit. Though when he first came in, he had said that he could not stay 5 minutes. It was very much against his inclination that he left home at all.
This was much more, as Emma felt, than he had acknowledged to her. The superior degree of confidence towards Harriet, which this one article marked, gave her severe pain. When Harriet had closed her evidence, she appealed to her dear Miss Woodhouse to say whether she had not good ground for hope.
I never should have presumed to think of it but for you. You told me to observe him carefully and let his behaviour be the rule of mine, and so I have. But now I seem to feel that I may deserve him, and that if he does choose me, it will not be anything so very impossible.
Harriet, I will only venture to declare that Mr. Knightley is the last man in the world who would intentionally give any woman the idea of his feeling for her more than he really does.
Harriet seemed ready to worship her friend for a sentence so satisfactory, and Emma was only saved from raptures and fondness, which at that moment would have been dreadful penance, by the sound of her father's footsteps in the hall. Harriet was too much agitated to encounter Mr. Woodhouse, and hastened away. The rest of the day, the following night, were hardly enough for her thoughts. How to understand the deceptions she had been practicing on herself and living under? She perceived that she had acted most weakly, that she had been imposed on by others in a most mortifying degree, that she had been imposing on herself in a degree yet more mortifying, that she was wretched and should probably find this day but the beginning of wretchedness. To understand, thoroughly understand her own heart, was the first endeavour. To that point went every leisure moment which her father's claims on her allowed, and every moment of involuntary absence of mind. How long had Mr. Knightley been so dear to her, as every feeling declared him now to be? When had he succeeded to that place in her affection which Frank Churchill had once for a short period occupied? She saw that there never had been a time when she did not consider Mr. Knightley as infinitely the superior, or when his regard for her had not been infinitely the most dear. She saw that in persuading herself, in acting to the contrary, she had been entirely under a delusion, totally ignorant of her own heart, and, in short, that she had never really cared for Frank Churchill at all. This was the conclusion of the first series of reflections. She was most sorrowfully ashamed of every sensation but the one revealed to her, her affection for Mr. Knightley. Every other part of her mind was disgusting. With insufferable vanity had she believed herself in the secret of everybody's feelings, with unpardonable arrogance proposed to arrange everybody's destiny. She was proved to have been universally mistaken, bringing evil on Harriet, on herself, and, she too much feared, on Mr. Knightley. Were this most unequal of all connections to take place, on her must rest all the reproach of having given it a beginning. Mr. Knightley and Harriet Smith. Such an elevation on her side, such a debasement on his. Could it be? No, it was impossible. And yet it was far, very far from impossible. Oh! Had she never brought Harriet forward? Had she left her to marry the unexceptionable young man who would have made her happy and respectable in the line of life to which she ought to belong? All would have been safe. How Harriet could ever have had the presumption to raise her thoughts to Mr. Knightley, how she could dare to fancy herself the chosen of such a man till actually assured of it. But Harriet was less humble, had fewer scruples than formerly. Alas, was not that her own doing too? Who had been at pains to give Harriet notions of self-consequence but herself? If Harriet, from being humble, were grown vain, it was her doing too. Till now that she was threatened with its loss, Emma had never known how much of her happiness depended on being first with Mr. Knightley, first in interest and affection. It was only in the dread of being supplanted that she found how inexpressibly important it had been. In spite of all her faults, she knew she was dear to him. Might she not say, very dear? When the suggestions of hope, however, which must follow here, presented themselves, she could not flatter herself with any idea of blindness in his attachment to her. She had received a very recent proof of its impartiality. How shocked had he been by her behaviour to Miss Bates? His reaction was far, far too strong to issue from any feeling softer than upright justice and clear-sighted goodwill. One hope remained, however, at times a slight one, at times much stronger, that Harriet might have deceived herself and be overrating his regard for her. Wish it she must, for his sake, be the consequence nothing to herself but his remaining single all his life. Could she be secure of that, indeed, of his never marrying at all, she believed she should be perfectly satisfied. Let him but continue the same Mr. Knightley to her and her father, the same Mr. Knightley to all the world, and her peace would be fully secured. Marriage, in fact, would not do for her. Nothing should separate her from her father. She would not marry, even if she were asked by Mr. Knightley. It must be her ardent wish that Harriet might be disappointed, and when able to see them together again, she would see them henceforward with the closest observance. Mr. Knightley was expected back every day. The power of observation would be soon given. In the meanwhile, she resolved against seeing Harriet. It would do neither of them good. She wrote to her, therefore, kindly but decisively, to beg that she would not at present come to Hartfield, since all farther discussion of one topic had better be avoided, and hoping that if a few days were allowed to pass before they met again, they might be able to act as if they had forgotten the conversation of yesterday. Harriet submitted and approved and was grateful. This point was just arranged when a visitor arrived to tear Emma's thoughts a little from the one subject which had engrossed them sleeping or waking the last 24 hours. It was Mrs. Weston, unexpected but welcome as always.
I hope I am not disturbing you, dear Emma.
Of course not.
I have been calling on Miss Fairfax and took Hartfield on my way home. Mrs. Bates and Miss Bates were both so truly respectable in their happiness, thought so much of Jane, so much of everybody, and so little of themselves. With all the encumbrance of awkward feelings, however, Jane was silent, until I convinced her that an airing in the carriage would do her good. Once we were alone, and after much gentle encouragement, she spoke openly of the engagement. I was very much pleased with all that she said on the subject, and she was exceedingly grateful to Mr. Weston and I for the visit and our warm manner. I am convinced that the conversation must have been the greatest relief to her, pent up within her own mind as everything had so long been. She has suffered real misery during the concealment of so many months.
Oh, poor girl. She thinks herself wrong, then, for having consented to a private engagement.
Wrong? No one, I believe, can blame her more than she is disposed to blame herself. Nor does she believe her suffering can make her blameless in the matter. She dreads making the story known to Colonel Campbell.
Poor girl. She loves him then excessively, I suppose. It must have been from attachment only that she could be led to form the engagement. Her affection must have overpowered her judgment.
Yes, I have no doubt of her being extremely attached to him.
I'm afraid that I must often have contributed to making her unhappy.
On your side, my love, it was very innocently done. She was conscious also that she was not just unhappy but unreasonable. She named it as one natural consequence of the evil in which she had involved herself. The consciousness of having done amiss had exposed her to a thousand inquietudes and made her irritable to a degree that had been hard for Frank to bear. She then began to speak of you and of the great kindness you had shown her during her illness and desired me, whenever I had an opportunity, to thank you. I could not thank you too much for every wish and every endeavour to do her good.
If I did not know her to be happy now, which, in spite of every little drawback from her scrupulous conscience, she must be, I could not bear these thanks. For, oh, Mrs. Weston, if there were an account drawn up of the evil and the good I have done Miss Fairfax. Well, this is all to be forgotten. You are very kind to bring me these interesting particulars. They show her to the greatest advantage. I hope she will be very happy. It is fit that the fortune should be on his side, for I think the merit will be all on hers.
Nay, Emma, I cannot say so. Frank has behaved poorly. No one would deny it. But he is sincere, and his merits will, in time, I hope, be restored in your eyes. But, my Emma, are you well? You appear distracted.
Oh, perfectly. I am always well.
Mrs. Weston's communications furnished Emma with more food for unpleasant reflection by increasing her esteem and compassion and her sense of past injustice towards Miss Fairfax. Had she followed Mr. Knightley's known wishes in paying that attention to Miss Fairfax, which was every way her due, had she tried to know her better, had she endeavoured to find a friend there instead of in Harriet Smith, she must in all probability have been spared from every pain which pressed on her now. In knowing her as she ought, she must have been preserved from the abominable suspicions of an improper attachment to Mr. Dixon, which she had not only so foolishly fashioned and harboured herself, but had so unpardonably imparted. An idea which she greatly feared had been made a subject of material distress to the delicacy of Jane's feelings by the levity or carelessness of Frank Churchill's. The evening of this day was very long and melancholy at Hartfield. The weather added what it could of gloom. A cold, stormy rain set in, and nothing of July appeared but in the trees and shrubs which the wind was despoiling, and the length of the day, which only made such cruel sights the longer visible. The weather continued with much the same gloom all the following morning, and the same loneliness and the same melancholy seemed to reign at Hartfield. Mr. Woodhouse could only be kept tolerably comfortable by almost ceaseless attention on his daughter's side, and by exertions which had never cost her half so much before. It reminded her of their first forlorn tête-à-tête on the evening of Mrs. Weston's wedding day. But Mr. Knightley had walked in then and dissipated every melancholy fancy. Alas, such delightful proofs of Hartfield's attraction, as those sort of visits conveyed, might shortly be over. If all took place that might take place among the circle of her friends, Hartfield must be comparatively deserted, and she left to cheer her father with the spirits only of ruined happiness. The child to be born at Randall's must be a tie there even dearer than herself, and Mrs. Weston's heart and time would be occupied by it. They should lose her, and probably, in great measure, her husband also. Frank Churchill would return among them no more, and Miss Fairfax, it was reasonable to suppose, would soon cease to belong to Highbury. They would be married and settled either at or near Enscombe. All that were good would be withdrawn. And if to these losses, the loss of Donwell, were to be added, what would